Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Radio Derb is on the air. That was one of Franz Joseph Haydn's Derbyshire Marches. And this is your calorifically genial host, John Derbyshire, with commentary on the week's news. I'm sorry to report that the big story this week remains the wretched business of the federal debt ceiling. Let's take a look. Oh boy, the debt limit. If you're tired of hearing about the debt limit, boys and girls, believe me, you're not as tired of hearing about it as we ink-stained wretches are tired of reporting about it. The story just drags on and on. You really have to care about politics to keep up your interest here. Personally, I keep myself going on regular doses of Pellagra. But even so, it's not easy to maintain one's enthusiasm. It doesn't help a bit that the bogosity quotient of the politics here is exceptionally high, even by Washington, D.C. standards. Both sides of the debt limit talks are promising to do this by 2020 or that by 2018, when we have no clue what the circumstances of the world or the nation will be like, and when, of course, nobody in either of those years will remember anything politicians said back in 2011. Still, we must do our best. So, what's happened this week in Debt Limit City? Well, the headliner this week was the Gang of Six plan. The Gang of Six is a bipartisan group of senators, three from each party, who, after 6 months' deliberation, this week produced, yes, a plan. The phrase bipartisan group of senators raises two red flags right away. Bipartisan is a pretty sure signal that Republicans are shuffling into position to have their rear ends kicked by Democrats. Senators are basically like members of the House, only with fewer scruples and less modesty. Theodore Roosevelt opined that, quote, "When they call the roll in the Senate, the senators do not know whether to answer present or not guilty." The really big red flag came up on Tuesday, after the Gang of Six plan had had a decent public airing, when President Obama told reporters that he likes the plan. Uh-oh. The president actually bestowed his favour with one of those gustatory metaphors he seems to have taken up lately. Last week it was peas. This week, it was turkey. Quote from the president, "My hope, and what I will be urging Speaker Boehner, Nancy Pelosi, as well as Leader Reid and Mitch McConnell, is that they, tomorrow, are prepared to start talking turkey and actually getting down to the hard business of crafting a plan that can move this forward in time for the August 2nd deadline that we've set." End quote. So, last week it was the veggies, this week it's the meat. If some other bunch of Congress critters come up with yet another plan next week, and Obama derides it as small potatoes, we'll have a balanced meal. So, what's in it, this Gang of Six plan? Let's see. $500 billion in immediate spending cuts, a four-year cap on spending by federal agencies, a freeze on congressional pay, some vague overhaul of the big three entitlements, and, oh, what's this? Hold on, it's in small print. I need a magnifying glass here. Right, what's it say? Increasing tax revenues by $1 trillion. By ending various tax breaks and loopholes while lowering all income and corporate tax rates. Aha! Nice Clean tax code. No more breaks and loopholes. Yeah, that'll happen. Remember that old movie, The Lost Weekend, where Ray Milland's an alcoholic who hides his whiskey bottle by hanging it outside his apartment window? That's how it is with an uncontrollable addiction. Whatever kind of plan the Congress lushes come up with, you can be sure that before the President's signature is dry on whatever legislation they pass, they'll have a bottle of whiskey hanging outside the window. Also on Tuesday, the House passed a bill nicknamed Cut, Cap and Balance. This was gestural. The thing has no chance with the Senate or the President. Even if it did have, there'd be a bottle outside the window, you may be sure. Nothing but a catastrophe will stop the critters spending. Ergo, the catastrophe must come. I'd say more, but the pellagra's worn off and I've lost interest. Let's talk about something else. Radio Derb's heroine of the week was Wendy Murdoch. Wendy is what the French call une femme formidable, i.e., you really don't want to mess with her. She is, in fact, Chinese by birth. Her name, Wendy, means something like cultured enlightenment. Her original birth name was Wenge, which means cultural revolution. Wendy was born in 1968, when Mao Zedong's great proletarian cultural revolution was well underway, and everyone in China was striving to be more revolutionary than the next guy. One way to display revolutionary credentials was to give your baby a revolutionary name. Note that makes Wendy 42 years old. Wendy's husband is billionaire media baron Rupert Murdoch, who is 80 years old. The couple married 12 years ago, when Wendy was 30 and Rupert was 68. That's some age difference. But he was a billionaire and she was cute. Inevitably, Wendy got tagged as a gold digger, and the British press had a lot of fun with that, helped along by Murdoch's old nickname, Digger, which is common British slang for an Australian, which Rupert Murdoch is by birth. The impression of Wendy as a gold digger was fortified by the circumstances of her past. She had single-mindedly climbed out of her poor provincial Chinese background, getting herself to the USA and acquiring a green card by seducing an American engineer, also 30 years her senior, when she was at college. She left that guy, got herself an internship with Murdoch's organization, and put herself in Rupert's way. As we say in mathematics, the result followed. Collateral casualties included Anna, Murdoch's wife of 32 years, with whom he had three of his six children. Public sympathies in Britain at the time were all with Anna, perceived as British and meek, while Wendy was foreign and pushy. 12 years of being a model wife and mother, and nursing Rupert through prostate cancer, didn't do as much as they should have to improve Wendy's public image. Then, on Tuesday, Rupert was in London giving evidence to a parliamentary committee on the scandal over journalists at his newspapers hacking into people's cell phones. A comedian, I mean an actual working comedian, stage name Johnny Marbles. This comedian decided to get some free publicity by doing the custard pie thing on Rupert. You don't actually use a custard pie for these stunts, just a paper plate covered with shaving cream. So at an opportune moment, Mr. Marbles stepped forward with his pie and started swinging it in the direction of Rupert Murdoch's kisser. Rupert's other kisser, which is to say his wife, Wendy, was sitting right behind Rupert. Before Mr. Marbles could connect pie with face, the enraged Wendy leapt to her feet, leaned forward over hubby, and gave the assailant an almighty smack upside the head. Quote from Mr. Marbles, talking to reporters after security people had tackled him and led him away. Quote, "I remember the rage in her eyes. I could see there was genuine emotion in her eyes. I wouldn't like to have a rematch with her." End quote. Now, Wendy's the heroine of the hour, and the phrase "tiger wife" is on everyone's lips. Wendy is at last received in all the best drawing rooms, and celebrity wives all over, from Kate Middleton to Melanie Trump, are signing up for Kung Fu classes. There isn't much for the editorialist to do with a story like this, except just to tell it, and to express general approval of Wendy's conduct. Speaking as one media baron to another, in a spirit of friendly competition, I wish Rupert Murdoch many more years of activity and good health, and I congratulate him on his choice of mate. It says here in the Washington Times that China is developing electromagnetic pulse weapons. Watching Wendy in action on Tuesday, seems to me they've got a pretty formidable aggressive potential right there. Wendy Murdoch's sudden ascent from heartless gold digger to fearless tiger wife belongs in the larger category of stories about the wives and children of famous people. To what extent are their doings any of our business? Opinions here fall on a spectrum between two extremes. At the privacy end of the spectrum is the position that a famous person's spouse and kids are nobody's business but his own, and it's rude to notice them in any way. At the exposure end is the counter-argument that when a person is important, it's usually because he has power in some way. Power, that is, over the rest of us. In a free society, we should know all we can find out about that person's character, so we can judge how worthy he is of the power he holds. His dealings with his family, the decisions he makes about his wife and children, give us useful information about his character. These two positions don't map easily into left and right. Conservatives favour privacy in a general way. Yet you can't help but notice that there's nobody more private than a left-wing dictator. Can you name Stalin's wife or any of Mao Zedong's children? And conservatives also favour modesty and humility in those who rule. At some point, an excessive concern for your own privacy is immodest. It says, "I'm so important, I need this 20-foot razor-wire-topped wall around my estate." It's one of those eternal arguments. Radio Derb's experience of life has been that it doesn't take much to make a person insufferably pompous and self-regarding, so that anything that reminds the famous of their mere ordinary humanity is a good thing. Of course, that needs qualification. The occasional custard pie in the face, for example, would be an excellent such reminder. Unfortunately, our world is well supplied with homicidal lunatics, who cannot easily or instantly be distinguished from mere unscrupulous self-promoters like Johnny Marbles. So the famous need some extra protection and precaution. What about their nearest and dearest, though? at just about the same time that a powerful man was being admirably defended in London by his gutsy wife, over in Chicago, a different powerful man was asked about his own decisions regarding his children. This was Rahm Emanuel, recently elected mayor of Chicago, and prior to that, Barack Obama's White House chief of staff. In an interview with NBC's Mary Ann Ahern, Emanuel was asked which Chicago school he'd be sending his kids to. Emanuel got testy, telling the interviewer it was none of her business. When she persisted, he unclipped his lapel mic, stood up, and walked out of the studio. Ahern later told us that before leaving, Emanuel had crossed over from testy to outright obnoxious. Quote from her. As I tried to explain further, Emanuel doubled back. He looked directly at my two college interns and said, "You are my witnesses." Then the mayor of Chicago positioned himself inches from my face and pointed his finger directly at my head. He raised his voice and admonished me. How dare I ask where his children would go to school? End quote. Now, you might say that Rahm Emanuel was just as admirably forceful in protecting his kids as Wendy Murdoch was in protecting her husband. There's a case to be made there. I would just point up two differences. First difference. Say what you like about Rupert Murdoch. He made his money by selling people a product they wanted to buy. He operates in the realm of free choice and free commercial exchange, the driving energies of a free capitalist society. Rahm Emanuel is a politician. Apart from a couple of years as a rainmaker for a financial firm, he's never done private sector work. Like Barack Obama or Bill and Hillary Clinton, Emanuel has attained wealth beyond the dreams of avarice from what people like that winsomely refer to as public service. The USA wasn't supposed to be like this. Our founders certainly favoured rich people doing a public-spirited stint in politics, but they never thought politics should be a road to riches all by itself. Second difference. As important as Rupert Murdoch is in his line of business, it's open to any citizen to ignore him and his news outlets completely. You can read the New York Times, watch CNN, and listen to NPR if you like. The people of Chicago can't ignore their mayor like that. His decisions affect their lives willy-nilly. Rahm Emanuel is chief executive of a city of 3 million people. Those people should find out all they can about his character, and reporters should help them to find out. Your decisions about how to educate your kids give us useful insights into your character, especially when you're responsible for a big city school district. There isn't much doubt that Rahm Emanuel's kids will attend a Tony private school. As a father, the mayor is right to get his kids the best education he can afford. I've done the same for my kids. As a senior municipal official, though, and a liberal Democrat funded by public school teacher unions, Emanuel has just added one more confirmation that the rich political elites to which he and Barack Obama belong are solidifying into a separate caste, who want as little to do with the rest of us, the great unwashed, as possible. His anger at being questioned about his kids' schooling also, I think, bespeaks a guilty conscience. Here's a man of the left, who is supposed to keep the interests of the common man close to his heart. Yet plainly, Emmanuel's choice for his kids is to remove them as far from the common man as it is possible to get. He has to know his own hypocrisy. And few things are more infuriating than being confronted with one's own shortcomings. The Obamas, Clintons, and Emmanuels made their piles by harvesting votes from ordinary citizens, people whom they now, in their personal lives, do everything they can to avoid. Now they're waving goodbye to the suckers who voted for them, retreating to moated castles like medieval aristocrats. This isn't what America was supposed to be. It surely isn't how egalitarian leftists are supposed to behave. Included in the general matter of finding out as much as we can about the people running our public affairs is the particular matter of finding out as much as we can about the state of their health. You don't want to go to the trouble and commitment of donating to a candidate and voting him into office and then having him die on you. Nor do you want someone in office who's going to be incapacitated by illness some significant portion of the time. The news that Michelle Bachmann suffers from severe migraine headaches came in a report on the Daily Caller website Monday. The report was written to make your flesh creep. Quote, "These episodes, say witnesses, occur once a week on average and can incapacitate her for days at a time. On at least three occasions, Bachmann has landed in the hospital as a result." End quote. You have to be somewhat sceptical. Liberals detest Mrs. Bachmann for having escaped from the feminist plantation. In the mind of a left liberal, women and minorities are supposed to be left liberal too, and faced with one who isn't, there's an instinctive reaction of anger and disgust. Daily Caller is not a liberal website by any means. It's associated with the Cato Institute, which is Beltway libertarian. Still, when this stuff is in the air, it's not impossible that non-leftists might inhale some of it. Note that word Beltway, too. Mrs. Bachmann isn't much of a favourite with any of the big Washington, D.C. wonk establishments. She's not just off the liberal plantation. In some important ways, she's also off the neocon and libertarian plantations, too. She has, for example, been the loudest voice in Congress protesting the Pigford settlement that's sluicing billions in public money to bogus farmers claiming to have suffered discrimination at the hands of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There's hardly been a squeak from other conservatives in Congress about Pigford. They're too scared, Keith Olbermann might call them, racist. Michelle has likewise been off the neocon plantation on immigration. The immigration restrictionist group, Numbers USA, ranks all presidential hopefuls according to their positions on 12 key issues relating to immigration and citizenship. Michelle is out ahead of the pack, overall grade B-, with the highest possible rating on 5 of those 12 policy issues. Opposing amnesty, mandating E-Verify, securing the borders, supporting local enforcement, and ending birthright citizenship. Tim Pawlenty comes second in the ratings with a C+. Then there's Herman Cain with a C-, and no one else scores better than a D. So the Daily Caller story could be leakage from the left-liberal war on Mrs. Bachmann. Or it could be neocon infiltrators opening a new front against her. I reserve final judgment, but remain sceptical. On the actual migraine issue, Wednesday the candidate released a letter from a congressional physician, no less, telling us that, quote, "Your migraines occur infrequently and have known trigger factors of which you are aware and know how to avoid," end quote. Apparently, the Congress lady takes two types of medication for her headaches, neither of them seriously narcotic. It sounds like a non-issue to me. We're heading into election season, though, and campaign staff will dig up what they can, so be ready for more of this. Another possibility there is that Texas Governor Rick Perry is gearing up to announce a presidential run, and part of the gearing up is oppositional work against other GOP candidates. Certainly the Michelle Bachmann wing of the Republican Party, which is to say more or less the Tea Party movement, does not see eye to eye with Governor Perry. Tea Party websites are filling up with anti-Perry polemic. Check out, for example, the website of the New Hampshire Tea Party movement. It's www.nhteapartycoalition.org. Sample quote: Rick Perry was Democrat Al Gore's Texas campaign chairman in 1988. Then Karl Rove recruited opportunistic Perry to switch parties so Perry could win the post of agricultural commissioner as a Republican. Rick Perry is a Trojan horse for statism, cloaked in Tea Party rhetoric and Christian Bible talk buzzwords. Very cynical. End quote. Other commentators point out that in a season when we're all obsessing about debt, it's worth noticing that Texas state debt has more than doubled in Perry's 10.5 years as governor, and the state's debt-to-GDP ratio is worse than California's. Perry, we're being told, is a globalist, big government, illegal immigrant-friendly rhino like George W. Bush, who, I note incidentally, in light of what's gone before, and whatever you think of his presidency, sent his daughters to public schools. Well, as I said, there's going to be a lot more of this. Campaign season is getting underway, and the conscientious citizen is going to have to sift through a lot of oppositional stuff, not just from the left against the right, but between GOP candidates. My wonkish acquaintances and colleagues tell me it'll end as a three-way fight between Romney, Bachmann, and Perry. If that's correct, I'll be rooting for Michelle. But there's a way to go yet. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Item: congratulations to the proud nation of Belgium. On Monday this week, the people of Belgium celebrated 400 days without a government. What a blessed nation. Actually, quite likely to be two blessed nations soon, as the main cause of deadlock over there is the desire of the Flemish-speaking North Belgians to get away from the French-speaking Southrons. Perhaps you should send down some of our own multiculturalists to teach them how to celebrate diversity. Meanwhile, let's fondly imagine the joys of a totally incapacitated government. And let's also, equally fondly, recall the days when plucky little Belgium stood fast against the Hun. Belgium put the guy boys on the Kaiser. Europe dropped the cane and made him sore. And we'll make the German bend, play the tune we understand. Rule Britannia rules the waves forevermore. That's a British one. item. A year or so ago, there was some public discussion about Hispanic crime rates. I forget the result. Most likely it was that everyone came away believing whatever they'd believed when they walked in. Well, this week we got a little insight into how these statistics are gathered. The state of Texas published its 10 most wanted poster. Here are the names of the 10 most wanted. All male. Gaspar E. Loya. René Morales Munoz. Javier Morin Jr. Gwen Camachit. Ricardo Zuniga. Jesus Alberto Villegas. Ernesto Alonso Garcia. Alfonso Gomez Quiros. Robert Barrera Jr. Javier Cortez Jr. Got those names? Okay. Here are the ethnic descriptors of the 10, as given on the Texas Crime Stoppers poster, in the same order. White male. White male. White male. American Indian male. White male. American Indian male. White male. White male. White male. Hispanic male. Just something to bear in mind next time you're reading about the analysis of crime statistics by ethnicity. Item. Here's a presidential GOP candidate announcement I somehow missed. Michigan Congressman Thaddeus McCotter, who announced over the July 4th weekend. You'd have to consider Representative McCotter as a long shot at this point, but it's early days yet. Conservatism-wise, he's a mixed bag. He supported minimum wage laws and the auto company bailouts. But on the other hand, he voted against Obamacare, and he blows the rest of the GOP field out of the water on national question issues. Those rankings from Numbers USA put him at a rare A+ on immigration. On the personal side, Representative McCotter is 45, plays in a rock band with the encouraging name The Second Amendments, and he is a devout Roman Catholic. So, take a look. The guy's a bit too much of a war hawk for my taste, but those immigration ratings are certainly impressive. And let's face it, you may never have another chance to cast a presidential vote for a guy named Thad. That's it, ladies and gents. I don't know how things are elsewhere in listener land, but here on the right coast we're stuck in a tremendous heat wave. Here in Manhattan, the road surface is buckling, the yuppie lawyers are loosening their ties as they scurry from one deposition to another, and nobody wants to be in the half of the subway car that the wino is sleeping in. I'm heading up to the 96th floor for canapes and a few cooling draughts of Veuve Clicquot with Jonah and the girls in the grotto. We shall, I promise, be thinking with affection and concern of you poor peasants toiling away in the heat down below. Ah, the dignity of labour.